gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the wonderful procrastination in the sunny South Slave. South Pacific, but it came out wrong. Anyway, my very special guest is going to be recently announced his mayoralty for the Auckland Council. His name is John Minto, a veteran protester who also helps out at Unite Union. Minto, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Vincent.
All right, glad to have you with us. Can you tell us why you decided to run for mayor?
Well, I decided to run because Mana is the political party that I'm involved with, and we have got some big, exciting solutions to the very big problems with which Auckland is facing at the moment, and we want to put those forward in the election and give people a real alternative to the corporate rule which Auckland has had for certainly the last several decades in the time that I've been in the city.
Could you define Auckland's corporate rule exactly?
Well, I think Auckland, in my time here since the 1970s, has always had right-wing councils that have failed to invest in public projects, and we've got a city which is now well behind the eight ball in lots of ways, particularly things like public transport, public housing. Those, in fact, will be the two big issues, I think, for the election. And it's a city which has been run by private enterprise for private enterprise. And through disillusionment and apathy, the people of Auckland haven't engaged in local body elections for a long time. So by default, the right wing have had it given to them on a plate.
Okay. Now, how exactly are they manufacturing their corporate control? Does the business roundtable or the so-called Council of Auckland have anything to do with this?
Well, yeah, I think so. There's various ways in which that corporate control transpires, but I think the very strong support for, particularly for the citizens and ratepayers from the business community in Auckland, has meant that they have had a monopoly on council for a very long time. The last council was more evenly balanced between the centre and the centre right. And I put the City Vision candidates, most of them would fit into the centre rather than into the left, although some of them would argue are good left-wing people. So I think the last council was a little bit of a surprise and a good surprise, in that there was a small shift towards the centre. But we've still got council effectively controlled by the right wing, by business, and they have exerted their authority over the direction of Auckland for many decades now.
Well, let's start with an example then. Would you have an example of what's happening in Auckland right now and how you would do it different? Let's say transport.
Well, transport's a really big one, and we've got an exciting proposal to put to the people of Auckland about the way we could deal with traffic congestion in a very creative, positive, forward-looking way, which would be of benefit to everybody. But, Vincent, look, I'm not in a position to announce that policy at the moment, because we're going to announce it at the launch of our campaign, which will be later next month in June. At the moment, I can say that we've got the problem. We know what the problem is. It's traffic gridlock. It's the fact that there has been underinvestment in public transport for many decades, and the answer from the business elites has been, roads. These people are addicted to the smell of car seal, and they do not want any public sector involvement, or at least to keep the public sector involvement to an absolute minimum, because ideologically they believe the market should be providing these solutions, and clearly the market has completely failed in transport as in many other areas.
Well, that's because, in my opinion, the market is not a free market. It's simply a bunch of corporate crony scum who own and control pretty much everything that they want and do whatever they want.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And when we talk about markets, very often they are completely fake markets. If you take the electricity sector, for example, we've got in the 1990s, National set up this this market. They promised us it would be, it would deliver lower power prices. They promised it would deliver more greater efficiency, greater stability of power supplies. But in fact, what has happened is that what they did then was they chopped up our electricity sector for a country of 4 million people, tiny country. They chopped up our electricity sector into a number of competing organisations and then said, it's going to be, you know, it's going to work much better because this is a market. But in fact, it was an artificial market. And the way they set the electricity price was wrong. It was obviously going to end in a rort of the people of Auckland. And of course it has. We've had electricity prices rising at more than twice the rate of inflation for the last 12 years. So the market has been a failure. In fact, it was a fake market, and it operates not so much as competing companies, as just a bunch of companies joined effectively in a cartel to keep prices high and keep screwing the public.
Yeah, this is my... if we segue here from the mayoral campaign onto the asset sales, I'd be much obliged as well, because this is the kind of thing that doesn't make sense. Let's say you had a free market, and we don't. It's so very difficult for any kind of electricity provider to provide electricity efficiently, effectively, and cheaply to such a small country.
Yeah, it is. It's absolute madness. We've had, in the time I grew up, you know, my parents' generation built a marvellous infrastructure based on hydroelectricity, which is the cheapest electricity in the world. They built that in the dams in the South Island and along the Waikato River and invested heavily in it. And the result was marvellously cheap electricity for the people of New Zealand. But then we had the corporates getting on the back of that. We've got Comalco, the Comalco aluminium smelter owned by Rio Tinto, and that smelter has worked there for about 50 years now, and it has taken 15% of New Zealand's electricity. And even though we produce it cheaply, they get it far cheaper than even that. So they're paying probably less than a third of what domestic consumers pay in electricity prices here. So it was set up for the corporates. And then, of course, with this privatised model, free market model, and the chopping up of these companies and the creation of artificial markets, we've just become... You know, we've just become the suckers who are paying through the nose for the profits of these companies. And now, of course, because they're so profitable, the government wants to privatise them to give their wealthy friends the best opportunity to make even more money off the hard work the ordinary New Zealanders do.
It appears to me this is happening in a lot of countries around the world. And for those who would come up and tout privatisation of power companies, strategic resources to a country, and say that it's a good thing, I would like for them to state me one example of anywhere in the entire world that this has actually benefited anybody. Because all the examples that I've seen from Argentina, to Australia and America and everything of that nature, it has never worked out well for anybody. And even Branko Milanovic from he's the lead research economist at the World Bank, I believe, in terms of inequality. He says point blank, privatisation does not work.
Well, he's absolutely right. It doesn't. And if you think about it for a moment, it can't. Because what you're doing between the public and the service that's there to be provided to the public, they are putting private companies. So as soon as you put a private company between the supply and the reception of that supply, then you've automatically got to pay a premium because the private company wants to make a profit. So they make profits by increasing their prices they employ below what would be paid for normally. And so in those two ways, they make a lot of money, and the rest of us pay for that in increased power prices.
How did this happen with Telecom? As far as I know, Telecom, when it was owned by Bell Atlantic, which is incidentally a World Bank affiliated company, they didn't maintain lines properly and things of that nature, quality of service.
Look, Telecom is a classic example of an epic fail in privatisation, because Telecom used to be run by the post office under the rubric of the post office. There was the we had telecommunications, the phone lines, we had the parcel deliveries, you know, the postal deliveries, and we had the Post Office Savings Bank, and they were all in one unit. And what Labor did in the late 1980s, they split that unit, Post Office, into three parts. And they created New Zealand Post, they created Telecom, and they sold the Post Office Bank itself to ANZ Australia. So they and so they privatised two parts, and we still hold the postal section. And what they did with when they sold Telecom, it was sold by it was set up for sale by Labor, and then National completed the sale in 1990, and National sold it for $4.25 billion, and they sold it to Bell Atlantic and Ameritech, two overseas organisations, overseas companies. And in the next 10 years after they sold it, the Bell Atlantic and Ameritech made $12 billion in profit from Telecom. And then when Bell Atlantic and Ameritech sold it in around 2000, they sold it for $12 billion. So over that period of 10 years, we effectively had about $20 billion siphoned out of the country by Telecom. And what Telecom did, because it had a monopoly, it cut staff dramatically, cut pay, and the service decreased dramatically. So the service dropped dramatically. And while in other countries telecommunication services were improving rapidly, in New Zealand they were static. We were way behind in the provision of broadband. And in fact, even now, we're still suffering from very poor quality, high-priced broadband compared to other countries. And that's because Telecom had a monopoly. It refused to invest. It employed 90 lawyers. And those 90 lawyers were there to lobby and to pressure National and Labor governments to prevent the monopoly being broken. And they just absolutely creamed it at the expense of the people of New Zealand. And even 4 or 5 years ago, the second-to-last CEO of Telecom, can't think of her name right now, she made a speech in Sydney where she said, "We all know what," to a telecommunications conference, "We all know what we're doing here," she said. "We're making profits out of creating confusing policies, confusing products, and the public are being ripped off, and we all know the game." It was that sort of comment, and of course it caused a Ferrari back here. But this is what Telecom was doing as a monopoly. They finally had the monopoly broken by David Cunliffe under Labor, but New Zealand has been just screwed, absolutely screwed blind, by both Labor and National following neoliberal policies and hoisting on the backs of the population these private companies, which are there to make profits and rip us off rather than provide affordable services.
Well, think about this. Imagine if they did that with everything. Imagine if they did that with every single road and turned it into a toll road. If they did it with every single power company. If they did it with, imagine if they did it, John, with the very New Zealand government. What if they privatised the government and said...
Well, I think there are, what they would like to do, not the government, but they want to privatise schools, they want to privatise hospitals, they want to privatise everything. That's the National Party agenda. It was the Labor Party agenda in the 1980s. They've moved away from that somewhat, but they're still deeply addicted to neoliberalism. They've they do want to privatise all those things, and we know what will happen is that you know, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, gross inequality, dramatic increase in social problems, and the country is not a country fit to bring a dog up in.
Yeah, essentially. That's the direction this country seems to be going.
It is the direction.
Now, we'll be coming to break in just a few seconds, so I just wanted to wrap this up, and I hope you'll hold over and stay with us for the duration of the hour, John, is that this country is a ripe, suckling pig. Think about it. It's being tenderized, basted, and roasted, so all that meat falls right off the bone and is able to be slurped up by vicious packs of wolves coming over the borders from overseas investment scumbaggery. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com with John Minto.
What is about? There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about a little bit of history repeating. Speaking of history repeating, John Minto is my guest. He's going to be running for mayor of Auckland. He's a longtime veteran protester. Now, can I ask you, John, over your vast levels of experience in protesting, I would act under the assumption you see the same things happening over and over again, yes?
Well, I guess so, yeah. I think that's a fair comment. I mean, I've been around since 1970s in Auckland here, and, you know, I've lived through a pretty dramatic transfer of power from the power and wealth, really, from the poor to the rich. So you do see the same pattern come back again and again under neoliberalism. These people are addicted to making profit off the work that other people do, and that's how the whole corporate neoliberal agenda works.
Yeah, it's basically like a leech, essentially.
Yeah, like a leech, like a parasite. They, you know, as I said before, the power companies, the government hoists these companies on the back of the community, so they can suck at will from us to get, you know, their fix of income which they haven't earned.
Now, I believe the spokesperson for this this asset sale as well. Minister Tony Ryle said that if the share price fell below a certain level, he wouldn't sell it. And it has fallen well below that level that he set, and they're still selling it.
Oh, you mean the companies themselves?
Yeah.
I think they've, for them, it's just straight ideological. Their object is not to get the benefit for the New Zealand taxpayer. Their object is to get these assets into the hands of their friends. So it's irrelevant to them in one sense. I mean, they say they're concerned about the share price, but in fact they're not. They're not worried at all. And they're going to bring two more power companies onto the market.
Yeah.
Which again means that they won't get as high a price. And, you know, but that doesn't matter. The New Zealand taxpayer is a sucker here, and the government is just, you know, screwing us over. It was good to see that the majority of New Zealanders right from the outset have opposed this asset sale. We had three quarters of the country opposed to it right from day one. And in fact, Vinny, if you look at every single privatisation which has occurred since the 1980s, every single one, there's been a majority of the public opposed to it. This is going right back into Labor's early days in the 19, or particularly the second term of that Labor government in the 1980s. People opposed every single asset sale, but National and then Labor went ahead anyway. And in fact, if you look at those elections going back from 1987 right through to 2000, every single election, the public voted against Rogenomics. They voted against asset sales. They voted against privatisation. But whichever government was elected, they were elected on one set of policies and then quickly reverted to neoliberalism across the board. So no matter who you voted for, you ended up with neoliberalism. And that was the reason we ended up with MMP, because by the end of that period, people were getting so pissed off. They started to say, look, we've got to get rid of this duopoly, this national Labor running a free market. And so they voted in favour of MMP to try and bring in some moderating influence on these two big parties.
And then the unfortunate business is that Labor and National still dominate MMP as well.
They do, and I think... Yeah, they do, and that's a fair criticism of the left. I think that the left has not been able to effectively break that duopoly. And you have to remember the forces that we're up against are very strong, because it's the corporate sector, it's the Sky Cities of the world, it's the telecoms of the world that have funded both Labor and National to run their campaigns. You know, 30 or 40 years ago, Labor and National were genuine mass-based parties, and Labor would do its fundraising by running cake stalls. And they had a mass membership. They had hundreds of thousands of people who were members of the Labor Party, and they worked really tirelessly to fundraise, to support what people saw then as good policies, to maintain the welfare state, maintain decent paying conditions for workers and what have you. But then neoliberalism crushed all that, and Labor is now a shadow of what it was in terms of membership. And it doesn't have people to run cake stalls. And in any case, you'd have to run 1,000 cake stalls to get as much money as you get on one visit to the boardroom at Telecom, where they write out a cheque for $50,000 just like that. So that's the sort of money the Labor and National need to run their campaigns. They don't get it from ordinary people. They get it from the corporates, and the corporates dictate the policies that Labor and National go to the electorate with.
This is a form of corruption called state capture, where companies get control of the government at the policy level, so that
it's also called fascism. You know, when you have a merger of the state and corporate power, that's fascism. And I think we've seen, we see signs of that creeping fascism all the time. And the latest one is the GCSB legislation, which will allow our spy agency to spy on a whole, quote, class of people. In other words, all of the members of Mana, or all of the members of the Maritime Union, or all of the members of the Labor Party, for that matter, can be spied on by this organisation. I know I've said this before, but even now, this is probably the most serious attack on civil liberties that I've seen in my lifetime.
This is the Search and Surveillance Bill Mock 2, is it?
Yeah, well, this is the one here they've announced last week, where the spy agency, the GCSB, didn't follow its own rules, didn't follow the legislation, deliberately, systematically, over a long period of time, broke the law. It was not entitled, specifically prohibited from spying on New Zealanders, but it did, and it spied on 88 New Zealanders. Well, that's the ones that they have admitted spying on. There'll be a whole lot more besides that. But anyway, the 88 they've admitted spying on, those people are... This agency broke the law to do that. And then when they found out through the Kim.com thing, they found out to have broken the law, then suddenly the government turns around, and instead of castigating them, instead of demanding a complete wipeout of the senior management and the organisation, and the board control of the organisation, instead what they did was have introduced legislation to make it legal for them to do what they were doing illegally. So we've got a government which is hand in glove with the corporate sector, in this case, to spy on New Zealanders.
When the corporations take over the government, that's fascism, as history has proven. So if we were to think about New Zealand as a totalitarian state where the companies control everything, including the government, And anybody who resists the bankers or the giant, massive overseas global corporations, they will be surveilled, silenced, maybe even taken away to a government re-education camp at some point.
Yes, exactly. I think that's exactly the sort of thing that we're talking about. You know, if there is a serious threat to the status quo, then we will end up further down that route, and it will be done under the basis of law and order. That they'll blame extremists. They'll say it's when there are mass protests in the streets, they'll try and isolate it to a minority, blame the minority, arrest them, put them in jail, and run a police state to control everyone else.
So that's the future for New Zealand. And I always wonder that...
Chile have been through, lots of countries have been through police states where they've had democratically elected governments overthrown by American-backed manoeuvres using local politicians and army leaders. And, yeah, we could easily see that happen in New Zealand.
Well, is John Key used to work for the New York Federal Reserve Bank in New York... Is he an American agent come here to turn the country into a fascist dictatorship republic?
Well, I think he's here to do the job that the bankers want him to do. He's here to do the job the corporates want. And while he's doing that and doing it well for them, they'll keep him on. But if he fails to do that, he'll be out.
That's the choice in the Prime Minister we have, John. Isn't that quite frightening to you, that the only person that we seem to be able to get elected is a person who is there specifically to destroy the country?
Well, I'm not sure specifically to destroy the country, but certainly to keep the country, to keep New Zealanders in to keep ordinary New Zealanders struggling, yes. They're there for that, because the only way they can increase their profits is by further screwing down the living standards of the majority of people. So he's here to do that, to screw down the living standards of the majority of people. And that provides for a lot more income for the corporations. So I think that's where we're heading, and that's what his job is to do. But if it became too hard to make a profit here, they would want greater state powers for the government to be able to control the population, to make it more compliant. You know, I mean, some of these corporates won't be happy until we're all medieval serfs who are slogging day in, day out for them with no benefits and no hope or no opportunities to improve the standard of living of ourselves and our families.
Well, the only thing that actually equalizes any form of political power is the existence of a middle class. If you have the working class versus the rich elite, there's no buffer zone, and it's a complete despotic dictatorship type situation.
That's true. Yeah.
So the more that they milk the middle class, the more the middle class will be coming out of the political process and no longer participating in it, because, hey, they've got to go to work, they've got to raise their kids, they simply don't have enough spare money or spare time, for that matter, in order to politically participate whatsoever. And that's the agenda.
True, and around the Western world at the moment, the middle class is shrinking quite rapidly, and more people are effectively ending up as...
It's neo-slavery.
Ending up as part of the working class. In other words, they're middle class people who are losing their standing in the world, if you like, and they are losing the economic advantages that they used to have. Relatively well-paid jobs disappearing, and in the case of New Zealand, we're becoming a service economy rather than a manufacturing or production economy. And service economies always have low-paid, poor conditions of employment. So we're seeing the creation of lots more part-time, casualised jobs and less decent-paid jobs that the middle class would normally have been involved in. So, I mean, I think that's, you're right about the middle class has always, in a sense, maintained the rule of the elites, but it's becoming a clearer picture. and we've got the majority of people in a sort of a role of servitude. And that means that the challenges for us are greater, but the opportunities are greater as well.
Can we think about total solutions here? Because I'm very sceptical, and in fact I spoke with your party leader, Hone Harawira, about this, and I asked him, is it possible to actually make changes from inside Parliament as to how the country is really running? And he said to me that there's basically bugger all you can do from inside Parliament, because there's all these rules and all this scumbaggery that's going on, and and people don't want to listen. And I was just wondering, how much power does the how much real political recourse do the people really have? I mean, are we fighting a losing war against these people? Maybe we need a game changer.
Well, we do need a game changer. We you know, Hone's absolutely right. You can't do anything in Parliament unless you've got your army outside Parliament, if you know what I mean, unless you've got public support and public opinion behind you. Once you have the public opinion behind you, you can make changes through that, through the parliamentary process. But even then, it's extremely difficult because the corporates have their, they've really got their hand, or with their hands and their feet, if that's possible, around the throat of New Zealand. And they'll give a little bit of ground every now and again, but then they'll tighten up somewhere else. So there's very little that, that you can do through the parliamentary process, and that's why Mana, I joined Mana not because it's a political party, but because it's a political movement, and we're saying that if you have MPs, MPs are only one small part of your strategy. The rest of your strategy involves mobilising ordinary people to take action on the ground and in their local communities, both to change public opinion and to change the way their own communities run. So I think we've got a wee way to go. Mana's got a long way to go to gain the confidence of people that were able to do that. But I'm you know, from my personal point of view, I'm optimistic about it, and we're going to give it a really good go in the mayoral election and in the election campaign next year.
Yeah, well, it may not be a whole lot of choice, but there's certainly a lack of options. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen. John Minto is my guest, and we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the bleed of uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong with the world?
People welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Middle East is a modern.
You're listening live, hopefully, at American Freedom Radio. Radio.com. My very special guest for the remainder of this segment is the illustrious John Minto. You're kind of one of the country's most famous protesters, aren't you? John, are you there? No, we seem to have lost him for a second. We'll just give him a quick call back, if that works. John, are you there? He might be away for a bit. Just away from the computer. We'll come back to John when he returns to the phone. Okay. We'll have Penny Bright on the next segment as well. She's also running for the mayoral campaign of Auckland, also against this new GCSB search and surveillance type thing. They'll be able to surveil a whole lot of different political organizations and people throughout the country with absolutely no justification, just like they've been doing the entire time illegally. And what happens with liars is that they think that telling a lie and not being caught in the lie is the same thing as telling a truth. They're basically a bunch of really nasty people who have, how do I say this? No concern for morality. Or doing the right thing. They only do what they can. And this is the lesson of history, is that if you give people unchecked power, they basically take it to the limit, to things that ordinary people would find completely insane. In this country, we have gone absolutely nuts with power-mongering scumbags. They love it. They get away with it. And they continue to push the public all the time
into giving up even more of their freedoms, more of their liberties, and more of their money in order to ensure that these companies and other various individuals noted for their scumbaggery, like, well, basically every single cabinet minister that I can really think of, whether they be involved in the justice or climate change or the prime minister himself, who's also made himself the minister of tourism, as it turns out, they are all out for themselves. This is what psychopaths want at the end of the day. Two things and only two things. Power and control. Now, who among you would have such callous disregard for people? Who among you would be willing to sacrifice your countrymen and indeed your country? Can I ask, would you then stand up to these people if they did in fact do it to you? This is a dangerous situation that we find ourselves in, ladies and gentlemen. A situation of immense importance, perhaps more important than anything else that has ever happened in this country's history. Historically speaking, this country's very young. New Zealand is anyway. You know, and historically speaking, I guess our entire modern civilization is very young. Just walking around with cell phones now, that's a new thing. It's not more than 20, 30 years old or something like that since cell phones first appeared. Before that, the closest thing you could come to a cell phone was watching old school Star Trek and all the technology and stuff that's in there. And indeed, the so-called loving Federation world government that actually dominates it now kind of dominates today. Isn't that interesting? You know, you wonder how science fiction people get their ideas. I think they're all planned out, personally, to a large extent anyway. And I believe that it is quite likely that sci-fi scenarios may in fact become real. You know, if it's Blade Runner or something of that nature. And also, we have... excuse me, we've got Penny Bright calling in. Penny, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Vinny. Are we live?
Yes, we are. We've had John Minto drop off. I can't seem to get back a hold of him, so we'll have you fill in for the interim, and we have another hour afterwards. Now, he was talking about the GCSB being able to surveil political parties, and you were mentioning that to me on the phone before the show as well. I was wondering what your perspective was on it.
Well, breaking news, I've just finished half an hour ago talking to the Inspector General of the an Intelligence and Security, Paul Neza, because I've just made a formal complaint to Paul Neza because I have possibly the first reply to a Privacy Act request to the director of the GCSB, Ian Fletcher, wanting to know whether or not I'm one of the 88 New Zealanders who's been unlawfully spied on. Well, I followed the process as outlined by the Prime Minister's office, made a Privacy Act request directly to the director. I've waited a month and gone around a big fat circle because the reply that I've got is that they cannot confirm or deny. Well, what the hell is that all about? Because Rebecca Kitteridge, who's the Secretary of the Cabinet, who was given the job of doing this report on the GCSB, she said the one area of record keeping where they had done a good job was the warrants file. Somewhere in the GCSB office, there is a file that has 85 warrants from the SIS and 3 warrants from the New Zealand Police. And it's these warrants that the GCSB unlawfully relied upon in order to intercept and spy on New Zealanders. When, if you bother to read the GCSB Act for yourself, I did, and it took me less than an hour, and although I've never been to university or had a day's legal training in my life, I'm not stupid and I can read, and I really recommend people Google it and read it for yourself. It's absolutely crystal clear that they're not supposed to spy on New Zealanders, and there's no provision for the GCSB to rely on warrants that have come from the SIS or the police. The GCSB have to get their own warrants. And what I think's happened here is that those who are responsible at the GCSB, including the Prime Minister, including the Inspector General, including the staff who've done this unlawful spying, never even read the Act themselves. That's what I think, because the Act, in my view, is absolutely clear. The law doesn't need changing, it just hasn't been implemented.
Well, it occurs to me, Penny, that they don't read most of the legislation that goes through, because if they did read the legislation, then they wouldn't have plausible deniability.
Well, that's absolutely right. And what's fascinating to me, as a sort of a bit of a side issue here, Rebecca Kitteridge, who's now gone back to her job as the Secretary of the Cabinet, she pulled up the GCSB as not properly following the Public Records Act 2005, which I believe is an absolutely pivotal piece of legislation in this country. If you want genuine transparency and accountability, you must have proper, full and accurate written records. Well, guess what? You go to the Cabinet Manual, as I have, and what you see there is they talk about the need to store and dispose of records, but they don't make a big deal at all about creating records in the first place. So at the highest levels of what's perceived to be the least corrupt country in the world, we do not have proper written records in place. No wonder the Prime Minister and these other ministers get these brain fades, because if you had somebody taking the minutes, diary noting key appointments, writing up memos, you wouldn't have to rely on your memory. And when you're running a country, you shouldn't be relying on your memory. There is a lawful duty to create and maintain full and accurate records, and that is not happening at either central or local government. That's what I've discovered. Public Records Act 2005. Read it for yourself.
Nobody wants to read the legislation, Penny. It's too boring and written in all that legal junk speak.
Well, it's not.
Hold on a second. I want legislation to be written in English. Is that hard? You know, frickin' English that people can understand? The public has no idea what legislation is out there because they can't even read it.
Feel the fear and do it. Quite frankly, it's not unclear. All you've got are sentences broken into paragraphs, and at the front, you've got letters and numbers and brackets. Look, just read it. And, of course, there's a lot of people that have got a vested interest in trying to mystify it and make it all way too complicated. It's not complicated at all. I don't find legislation hard at all. And I'm a tradesperson, basically. Like I say, never been to university, but I can read. Anybody who can read, just have a go. Read for yourself, because I tell you what, you're probably doing a lot better than those who actually get paid public monies to implement the legislation you're reading. They just make it up.
I read the legislation for slavery and usury in New Zealand. Apparently, it's illegal to compel someone to pay you back money that you've loaned them and get them to do work for you. It's called usury. And I was just thinking, oh, my God, what about every single bank in this country? What about every single cop in this country that gives you a fine and commands that you pay it even when you don't have the money and they force you to do it anyway? Is that usury? Is that slavery? According to the legislation, it is. But again, you're right, Penny. All of the laws and everything that would actually make society run just perfect are already in the legislation. They're just selectively enforced so certain people can keep their hands on the power reins and control. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Penny Bright is my guest.